The headlines: two civilian deaths, multiple injuries as Israel launches an air raid against a central Syrian province. China accusing the United States of using democracy as a tool to divide the world. Plus, Apple sues an Israeli spyware company accused of helping government agencies hack into the mobile phones of their critics. Our top story for this half hour: Israel's aerial aggression against Syria taking more lives. Syrian media reporting two civilian deaths in the latest airstrikes targeting a central province. In the early morning hours, several people have also been injured. The Syrian air defenses intercepted the attack above the western city of Homs. Israel frequently strikes targets within Syria. Last week, it launched a missile strike against the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government accuses Tel Aviv of supporting terrorist groups that are operating on its soil. The UK's decision to outlaw Palestinian resistance movement Hamas continues to draw condemnations by Palestinian factions. In a conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip, the Palestinian factions voiced their support for the resistance front. Asher Shannon brings us more in this report.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip titled "Resistance is a Legitimate Right to Condemn the UK's Plan to Ban Hamas Movement." Hundreds of people attended the conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. On Friday, the UK's Home Secretary, Priti Patel, laid before the British Parliament an order to outlaw the Hamas resistance movement in its entirety. Patel made the order while giving a keynote speech at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. The proscription makes it a criminal offense in the United Kingdom to be a member of or invite support for Hamas, with those found guilty facing up to 14 years in prison.
The British decision to include Hamas on its terror list is biased and violates the rights of Palestinian people. With this decision, the UK has entrenched itself with the enemies of the Palestinian people. This decision has no value to Palestinians and will continue the resistance until driving out the occupiers from the land of Palestine.
The close relationship between the United Kingdom and the Israeli regime has been one of the most salient features in British foreign policy for decades.
Palestinian resistance factions are holding this national conference to assert their refusal to these British policies. The British Home Secretary is violating the international law by listing Hamas movement as a terror group. This biased British policy gives the Zionist enemy the green light to commit more war crimes against the Palestinian people.
All Palestinian factions have expressed shock and dismay and accused the UK of continuing with its aggression against the Palestinian people. Palestinians accuse the UK of committing a historic sin against them in the infamous Balfour Declaration and the British mandate that handed Palestine to the Israeli occupation.
It is our right to resist the Zionist occupation of Palestine. The UK's decision is a dangerous infringement on the right of the Palestinian people to resist the occupation and confront the aggression that our people have been subjected to for decades. Neither Britain nor anyone else can stop all forms of Palestinian resistance.
People in the blockaded coastal territory have always accused the United Kingdom of aiding and abetting the Israeli regime in its crimes against the Palestinian people.
Palestinians, like other oppressed peoples, have the right to resist occupation. Experts say that any attempt to accuse Palestinian resistance groups of terrorism is a violation of international law. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On this segment of the program, tensions heating up over Taiwan. Beijing criticizes Washington for inviting Taipei to a summit next month. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says the inclusion of Taiwan was a mistake, adding the United States uses democracy as a tool to press other countries and divide the world. President Joe Biden has invited Taiwan to attend the virtual democracy summit along with 109 governments. Taiwan says the event is an opportunity to show off its credentials on the world stage and share its democratic success story. China views Taiwan as its own territory and is against any move that violates the One China policy. The U.S. government has been irking Beijing by forging ties with Taipei through arms sales and official interactions. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have political commentator and analyst Angelo Giuliano joining us from Montreux. Also, we have writer and political analyst John White, who's joining us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Giuliano in Montreux. Give us your thoughts on the recent direction that the tensions between Beijing and Washington is taking, and also your thoughts about Washington inviting Taipei to this summit.
I think there is something very interesting that Jolly Jan, foreign ministry spokesperson, what he said about democracy. Democracy, I'm quoting him, democracy is the right of people of all countries, not a patent held by a few countries. Democracy is a value shared by all mankind, not a tool used by a few countries to intervene in other countries' internal affairs. Whether a country is democratic or not should not be judged by its people. It is important to understand that in China, according to a study by Howard University, 95% of people are extremely happy with their system. And this is the legitimacy of the democratic system in China, which is far more democratic than the U.S. So I think a lot of people do not understand the system. So what we're seeing here with Taiwan is very simple. The way it is going is that DPP and Tsai Ing-wen has been hijacked by the U.S. Tsai Ing-wen used to work with the AIT, the American Institute in Taiwan, which is actually de facto the embassy in Taiwan since 2005. So they have co-opted Tsai Ing-wen, and she's working more as a U.S. agent than working for Taiwanese people. So it is important that to understand that here right now, the democracy of Taiwan is actually being hijacked. You have institutes like National Endowment for Democracy, which is present in Taiwan. And we all know what National Endowment for Democracy does. It is about hijacking a democracy. And it's important to understand that when there is no sovereignty, you cannot have democracy. So right now, Taiwan is being held hostage of the U.S. State Department. So now the political party, the DPP, is working against Taiwanese people. And you can see right now in Taiwan, there's a huge majority of people that doesn't want to go into the direction that Tsai Ing-wen wants to take.
Let's cross over now to Mr. John White, who's with us from Edinburgh. Mr. White, give us your thoughts on the tensions right now. What the United States, you think, is trying to achieve by inviting Taiwan to this summit, and also if you'd like to add anything to what our guest in Montreux just mentioned.
Well, this latest crisis is part of a strategic shift in U.S. policy vis-a-vis China that has been ongoing not since the Trump administration, but even before that, under the Obama administration, with his famous or infamous 2011 Pivot to Asia speech, which he gave in Australia, announcing that the U.S. strategic priorities would shift from the West to the East in response to China's growing economic footprint and with it geopolitical influence. The One China policy has been the bedrock of Sino-U.S. relations since 1979, and there has now been a break from that policy because of China's growing influence, as I just mentioned. The Americans are panicking. There is panic abroad in Washington over China's growing economic and geopolitical influence across the world under its quite astonishing Belt and Road Initiative, and things are now reaching a point of critical mass, and this is a clear provocation, and it may well tip Beijing's hand because Beijing will not tolerate this attempt to treat Taiwan as an independent sovereign state in violation of the One China policy, and it may well result in military action to try and forestall this shift away from China's belief that Taiwan, understandably, is part of China and is a breakaway province rather than an independent sovereign state. And as far as my colleague is concerned, he's quite right to point the finger at the role of the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a front for the CIA, which is involved in destabilizing countries all over the world in the interest of US foreign policy. So there is a lot to unpack here. Clearly Biden is not the change president that he promised during his campaign. He is a continuity president when it comes to foreign policy, vis-a-vis US engagement with Iran over trying to resurrect the Iran nuclear deal, which the Trump administration unilaterally left and destroyed in 2018, or sabotaged in 2018, and also with regard to China. So we're in a very, very dangerous period, and I think this is redolent of the fading hegemonic power that is Washington, and is trying desperately to claw back its domination of these very vital strategic regions of the world.
Back to Mr. Giuliano. How serious are the tensions right now between Washington and Beijing, not just over Taiwan, but also about the South China Sea? How dangerous do you see it at this point? Will this, as our guests mentioned in Edinburgh, will this likely result in a military conflict or military standoff? And if so, what repercussions could it have, not just for the region, but for the world as well?
I think I would refer to a 2016 Rand Institute think tank paper about what the U.S. could do to China. And there are two ways to touch China, to contain China. One is to create a war between Taiwan and China. The other one is actually create a blockade in the Malacca Strait. And this is actually the weakest point of China. And this is actually why we have the Belt and Road Initiative, is to bypass the Malacca Strait. Because we could have, in reality, the same scenario as we had in World War II, where the U.S. did a blockade to suffocate Japanese economy, where the U.S. could do exactly the same. So now China is not at the level where it could actually fight this blockade. So this is why the Rand Institute says that there is a window of opportunity for the U.S. to attack China, and it's going to last between 2015 to 2025. So you see, it is very important not to see the short term, all those news, but more to see the funding, which are long term, you know, the propaganda funding. When USAGM is investing $300 million to propaganda against China, it's important to follow those think tanks that are actually funded by the major industrial complex. This gives you a better idea on long term plan. And the long term plan is confrontation and to contain China. In the worst case, I think the most probable scenario is a blockade, and this is why China is investing into its navy, because it's weak and it needs to get to the level of the U.S.
And Mr. White, last question to you. How serious do you think the tensions are at this point, and what could be the ramifications of these tensions?
I don't think they could be any more serious. I think a calculus has been made within Washington that it's time now to confront China before it becomes so big as a military power. China's navy is already larger than the US navy. I have to respectfully disagree with my interlocutor on that score. China's increasing its military capability at an astonishing rate. So I do think a calculus perhaps has been made that it's now time to confront China before it's too late, while the US still has more military capability to its hand. The only problem the US has is shaping China as an external enemy sufficiently enough to attract its support domestically. After the debacle of Iraq, that is a key component of any US foreign policy. You need to fashion a monster abroad in order to achieve cohesion at home. The Biden administration is embroiled in culture wars at home. That's going to be a key component. U.S. public support for or against any confrontation with China, and there really is a serious attempt to shape that public support in the media. If you look at U.S. media, it is wall-to-wall Sinophobia as I speak. So there's a very critical moment in the history of Sino-U.S. relations, and broader than that, in the stability of the region and, by extension, the world entire.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Angelo Giuliano, political commentator and analyst, joining us from Montreux. And thanks to writer and political analyst John White, speaking to us from Edinburgh. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. American technology company Apple files a lawsuit against an already notorious Israeli spyware maker. The iPhone maker says the NSO Group has used its Pegasus spyware to hack the devices of Apple users. The American tech giant says the Israeli firm manipulated its servers to deliver the attacks using more than 100 fake Apple IDs. The U.S. firm is now seeking a court order to permanently ban NSO from using Apple servers and devices. This is the latest in a series of legal actions against NSO. Just weeks ago, the U.S. blacklisted the spyware maker for enabling foreign governments to target opponents and activists. Facebook also sued NSO 2 years ago, accusing it of cyber espionage on journalists and activists. NSO denies all of that. It says its software is designed for use by authorities in fighting terrorism and other crimes. Press TV has conducted an exclusive interview with the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency during his visit to Iran. Rafael Grossi described the mood as positive, saying he's had excellent meetings with Iranian officials.
Where do you see this? You've had the meetings today, and of course in a few days the meetings will be taking place again.
Yes.
Your overall perspective and what you're...
My perspective is a positive one. I believe that we have to work in a way, Iran and the agency, and I had excellent meetings with the foreign minister just now, with other authorities, with the president of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, so that we can move in the clarification of certain outstanding issues that we have, and hopefully when the and if the JCPOA is restored, as I said before, to help the community of the JCPOA to bring this agreement into the fruition it was supposed to be created to.
Grossi was also asked about the agency's stance on Israeli acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program and its assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. He said the IAEA condemns any act of violence, although it does not conduct investigations or allocate responsibilities. He said peaceful uses of nuclear technology are the inalienable right of every state. However, the IAEA chief stressed that all countries should join the non-proliferation treaty designed to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. Grossi said he would like to see a world free from nuclear weapons, but added the IAEA has a non-proliferation mandate and not a disarmament one. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The unity of Muslims is a definite Quranic duty. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
May God have mercy on those who were among the people who truly believed in the unity of Muslims and believed in the unification of Muslims. I hope that God the Exalted will shower His mercy and blessings on the pure souls of all those whom we have named and those whom we have not named. There were many such people before them as well, people from Iraq, Iran, Egypt, and elsewhere. There are many people who have struggled in this field, but I cannot mention the names of all of them. Important points and needs deserving attention regarding unity. Muslims' unity is a definite obligation, not merely an ethical matter. I would like to raise a few points about the unity of Muslims. One point is that the unity of Muslims is a definite duty mentioned in the Quran and not something voluntary. We must look at it as a responsibility.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This is the command of the Quran. Hold fast all together by the rope of Allah and do not be divided. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 103. This means that even in holding onto the rope of God and obeying Him, we should do this all together. Hold fast all together by the rope which Allah stretches for you and be not divided among yourselves is a command. Why do we try to turn this command into a moral belief? This is a command and a decree that should be acted on. There are also many other verses in the Quran in this regard, such as, And fall not into disputes, lest you lose heart and your power departs. The Holy Quran, Surah 8, verse 46. Thus the point is that this is an obligation.
In Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Genoa U.S. Indian Industrial School, a government-run boarding school for Native Americans located on the edge of town in Genoa, Nebraska. Decades after its closure in 1934, researchers have unearthed the bleak history of this institution. They confirmed that over 100 Native American children died at this school, using newspaper archives and school newsletters to identify them, because official records were destroyed when the school closed. Search for the graves of children is in progress at the site of the Genoa school. Researchers said the true death toll is probably much higher. The passing of the Civilization Fund Act in 1819 by the U.S. Congress authorized the government to establish residential boarding schools and relocate Native American children by force. It's estimated that hundreds of thousands of children were sent to boarding schools operated by the government or churches across the U.S. However, some never returned home. Students were victims of harsh punishments and hard labor, and many of them died of diseases. One descendant claimed his great-grandmother was blinded while a student at Genoa, probably by having lye soap rubbed into her eyes as punishment. While they were removed from their families and homeland, children were prohibited from speaking tribal languages in a bid to subdue or eliminate the Native American culture. The narrative has an uncanny resemblance to Canada's residential school system. In the 19th century, Canada also established mandatory boarding schools for Indigenous children. 150,000 Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against children. This year, remains of 215 First Nation children were discovered at the site of a former residential school near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. Some of the children were as young as 3 years old. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners through the 20th century.
And just imagine this, somebody coming to your home and taking your children from you when they're 5 years old, 4 years old, and taking them away, and away from your influence, away from your understanding, away from your culture. That's what happens to Indigenous people in the United States and in Canada.
One of the tactics used by the U.S. federal government to destroy the culture, religion, and way of life of Native Americans was the establishment of boarding schools. The discovery in Genoa School is only a tiny part of the immense hardship colonial settlers inflicted on Native Americans. Back in the late 1700s, American colonies declared their independence from the rule of Britain. That became the foundation stone of the modern United States, a colonial state which expanded from a group of British colonies on the Atlantic coast of North America by displacing and killing millions of Native Americans. When Christopher Columbus reached the Americas in 1492, 10 million indigenous people lived in what is now the United States. By 1900, there were less than 300,000. Another atrocity against Native people in America is the implementation of the Indian Removal Act. In 1830, the U.S. federal government endowed itself with the right to take Native-held land east of Mississippi and forcibly relocate Native people from their homes in Georgia, Alabama, North Carolina, Florida, and Tennessee to Indian territory in what is now Oklahoma. in a mass atrocity remembered as the Trail of Tears. Tens of thousands of Native Americans died or were killed after fleeing their homes in terror.
The immigrants never had any land. They got here, and whatever they got in terms of land, they stole.
Native Americans were expelled from the lands they had lived in for generations. They were victims of wars, mass killings, and discriminations while the U.S. government destroyed their cultural traditions. Even today, discrimination and oppression against minorities exists in the U.S., as racial discrimination is systematic in American society. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is now designated as a terrorist organization by Britain following the Friday announcement of UK Home Secretary Priti Patel. The move brings Britain in line with the United States, which designated Hamas a terrorist group in 1995, and the European Union. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel justified the decision by arguing that it was not possible to distinguish Hamas's political and military wings. She claimed that Hamas has a significant terrorist capability and access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. This is while the group uses its weapons to defend the Gaza Strip against Israeli aggression. Patel also highlighted the importance of a ban to protect the Jewish community. The British official, however, did not make any reference to Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The British Parliament will vote on the proposals next week. If Patel's bid succeeds, showing support for Hamas in Britain could be punished with up to 14 years in prison. Israel applauded the news, with its foreign minister, Yair Lapid, saying the move was a result of joint efforts between the British and Israeli regimes.
And, of course, it was all in cahoots with Washington as well, apparently. The British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who announced this decision, made the announcement in Washington, not even in London. So you can see the Israelis, the British, and the Americans were all involved in this.
The London's decision adds the political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on the movement's military wing, Al-Qassam Brigades. This move has drawn widespread condemnation. The Palestinian Authority says the UK took the measures at Israel's request, adding that it's an unjustified aggression against the Palestinians and will hamper reconstruction efforts in the besieged Gaza Strip. Iran has also denounced the British measures. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. Hamas has slammed the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people.
The British Home Office's decision to consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
Hamas's spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians. The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the British government in 1917 during the First World War, which laid the foundations for the entity of Israel. The declaration is seen as a catalyst for the 1948 Nakba, where more than 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned the ban on Hamas, describing the move as an unjustified attack on Palestinians who have been subjected to the most heinous forms of occupation and historical injustice as a result of the Balfour Declaration. Following the blacklisting of Hamas, the resistance movement reacted, saying in a statement that, instead of apologizing and correcting its historical sin against the Palestinian people, Britain supports the aggressors at the expense of the victims. It also added, resisting occupation by all available means, including armed resistance, is a right guaranteed by international law to people under occupation. Hamas also urged its supporters to condemn the UK's move, as it described Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands, forcible displacement of Palestinians, the demolition of their homes, and the siege of more than 2 million people in the Gaza Strip as terrorism.
Well, implicitly, I guess it's saying okay to Israeli crimes, but no different from they've been saying okay to Israeli crimes since 1917. So in that sense, it's nothing new.
Based in Gaza, Hamas is a resistance group against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Hamas and Israel clashed most recently in a deadly asymmetrical war in May, during which the Israeli regime killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, through its continuous bombardment of the Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days.
The cost of living in the UK surged in October to a 10-year high, with the figure now more than double the target set by the Bank of England. The UK's Consumer Prices Index rose by 4.2% in the 12 months to October, up from 3.1% in September. Driven by a dramatic jump in household gas and electricity prices, the figure was higher than forecast by economists.
Now, there's a lot of different factors. The big one, of course, is the incompetence of Boris Johnson's government, which cut Britain off from its major sources of trade and raw materials, has made everything much more expensive. He's managed to introduce, they've reintroduced customs charges, they've reintroduced processing charges that didn't exist in a free market, so of course prices go up.
With the annual inflation rate more than double the 2% target set by the government for the Bank of England, the increase will put pressure on the bank to raise interest rates from as early as next month amid growing concern over the cost of living. Rising consumer prices have ramped up the cost of living, especially when wages have failed to keep pace. The Bank of England expects inflation to rise further to around 5% in the spring of 2022, before falling back towards its 2% target by late 2023.
Now, there are two aspects of all of this. Inflation is a question of the value of the currency. When the currency is devalued, you get inflation. But rising prices are a separate issue. Not all prices are rising. On the contrary, property and some things are going down.
As the impact of higher oil and gas prices fades and demand for goods moderates, household energy bills were the biggest driver of inflation after Ofgem, the energy regulator, lifted the price cap on domestic gas and electricity last month. It meant that gas bills rose by 28.1% in the year to October, while electricity climbed by 18.8%.
Most working people in the Western world have been on certainly in the Anglo-speaking world, have been on a petrol pay freeze since Ronald Reagan in 1975 in real terms. Their wages have been held down, while productivity and profits and the share that the bankers take has rocketed upwards.
Demand for oil and gas is pushing up energy prices worldwide. This means higher bills for householders and for businesses, many of whom will pass on some or all of the extra energy costs to their customers. UK authorities in October lifted the so-called energy price cap, which limits standard variable tariffs charged by domestic energy providers.
The effect is catastrophic. In Britain, the energy prices shot up, and the government's response was to cut back on the welfare spending, to cut back on the money that unemployed and ill people got. So they've deliberately targeted poorer people.
UK and European gas prices have hit one-month highs as concerns over winter energy supplies rise. Delays to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia have stoked fears of a winter natural gas shortage in Europe. Germany has suspended its approval process for the controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which would double its reliance on Russian gas, following growing geopolitical pressure to scrap the project. The suspension of the Nord Stream certification is a setback to Gazprom's plans to extend Russian gas dominance via a new pipeline across the Baltic Sea. Europe faces a looming winter gas crisis, which has fueled fears of a widespread industrial slowdown due to factory shutdowns and potential power outages. It is also expected to drive a cost of living crisis for homes and small businesses. Gas prices have reached record highs in recent months, ignited by the global surge in demand after the COVID-19 economic slowdown last year, and fueled by Russia's reluctance to export extra supplies to Europe to help meet demand, despite rocketing market prices.
The Sudanese military forced Omar al-Bashir out of the presidential post in August 2019. After Bashir's ouster, the military came under mounting pressure by mass street demonstrations demanding civilian rule. The military finally agreed to share power with civilian leaders. The two sides agreed to negotiate a path towards a democratic government. After the agreement, civilians and military leaders formed a joint committee known as the Sovereign Council to run the country together in what appeared to be a transition period before a democratically elected government takes charge. But the two sides were publicly at odds from the very beginning. Military leaders of the Sovereign Council kept demanding their civilian counterparts to replace the cabinet and implement reforms. Civilian leaders dismissed this as an attempt to seize power. Sudan experienced several failed coups since 2019. The country is right now in political turmoil following the military's latest try. Back in October, the military arrested Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok and his cabinet members and dissolved the government. Is the army trying to keep power, or is it genuinely committed to holding elections as it has promised? Army Chief General Abdel Fattah Abdelrahman Burhan says a vote will be held in July 2023. But Sudanese activists and demonstrators seem not to be buying that pledge. They have held several mass demonstrations calling on the general to cede power immediately. The army has clamped down on the protests in recent weeks, but the demonstrators seem to be undeterred by the bloody crackdown. The crackdown on anti-coup protesters has been getting bloodier. This means that pro-democracy camps and activists are facing an increasingly dangerous struggle. The violent crackdown has triggered international condemnation, with UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet describing it as utterly shameful to use live bullets against protesters. The current situation in Sudan is reminiscent of June 2019, before the democratic transition was agreed. That year, the army opened fire on protesters in the capital, Khartoum, killing scores of people. Undaunted by the latest violence, opponents of the coup have now pledged to intensify their protests against the military takeover. The Sudanese Professional Association, which led the popular uprising that toppled Omar al-Bashir, has been a major force against coup leaders. It has called for civil disobedience across Sudan. The African country is on the edge. Popular movements in Sudan have in the past been successful in forcing the generals to limit their involvement in politics. Is that the path the Sudanese people need to take again?
I do think that what we saw in 2019 with the protests were extremely positive in showing the rest of the world what the Sudanese people can do and what the Sudanese masses can do. However, even the Sudanese Communist Party had mentioned how important it was to recognize this material impact of the protests have not been recognized by the masses themselves. So the poor and working class Sudanese people have not yet seen any of their material needs resolved as a result of the protests. So that's probably the biggest push they're trying to see now, is ensuring that this next government actually does listen to their needs, material needs.
What's making the situation even worse this time is Sudan's economic crisis, with high inflation and nationwide shortages of food and fuel. The Sudanese army chief seems to have the final say, at least for now. But he is definitely in no easy position as tensions escalate and people lose their lives in violence. The international community has left little doubt that it disapproves of the developments in Sudan. All eyes are on the army now to see what direction it will choose.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now, all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, prevented the Muslims from practicing the following qualities. He, peace be upon him, said, "The owner of three traits will not die till he sees their evil results: oppression, cutting off ties of relations, and binding oath through which he fights with Allah. Indeed, the quickest obedience in reward is the relations with womb relatives. Perhaps some people are sinners. However, they visit each other, so their properties increase and they become rich. Binding oath and cutting off ties of relations leave houses empty of their people."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the differing conversations of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam with this divine wisdom. We find, dear friends, in one of these conversations that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is asked by one of the people to tell him some attributes and some characteristics of righteous people, of the believers, of the mu'mineen, the true believers. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he replies with three different kinds of attributes which are found in the righteous people. He says, be patient towards misfortunes. Number two, do not transgress Allah's rights. And number three, do not give a person a thing which will harm you more than it will benefit you. So here, dear friends, we find, first of all, that he says, be patient towards misfortunes. Of course, being patient towards misfortunes is considered one of the worship of Allah. It is worship of Allah when we are patient, when we are faced with hardships and trials and tribulations. The other one is to not transgress the rights of Allah. Do not commit sin. Do not break the commandments of Allah. Do not break the divine order of Allah. And finally, it's interesting. It doesn't seem like it would be that important, but Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam brings it up. He says, don't give another person a thing which will harm you more than it will benefit you. So be patient when a difficulty comes your way. And do not break the laws of Allah. Do not commit sins. As much as you can, stay away from sins. Ask Allah for help and ask Allah for forgiveness. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. Try to be understanding of the source you're getting the hadith from. If it's an unknown source, then there's a bigger question mark on it. If a random social media post says Amir al-Mu'mineen said this, then there's a bigger question mark on that. If he said it, sam'an wa ta'ata, we accept it, it's heard, it's we submit to it, and so on and so forth. But did he say it? There's no reference there. It's a big question mark. I can't accept this. If some speaker said this, what's their background? Do they have an authority to know hadith and present it? If they don't, again, a big question mark. If the person has got a background that we see the scholarship, the track record, he's careful, he has the access to these books, a little less of a question mark, but still a question mark until we can verify it, but the person we're getting it from, the people we're getting it from, that part of it is a little easier. And just because somebody uses some big words or throws out names of books doesn't mean that it's accurate. In this book it says that, in that book it says that. Some naive people are like, well, he must know what he's talking about. Well, there was a research by a so-called professor, Robert Gleave, in the UK, Exeter University. He's got some works. He's an expert on Akhbarism, the Mal'oon who the British Akhbarism growing in the subcontinent is because of this Mal'un's research. Anyhow, so he's got works on Akhbaris and Usulis at a very critical time, a type of work that unfortunately many Hausa students today, they haven't done their own homework. They look at the work of Robert Gleave, footnotes, reference number 1, 2, 3, 10 references. There's only that much text. The rest of it is footnotes with references. Like, oh my God, you know, he must know what he's talking about. Like, brother, you're a Hausa student.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Child poverty in Britain. Part 2.
There are very large numbers of people that question the war in Afghanistan, question the war in Iraq, and question the intervention in Libya, saying that really, really what those wars are about, demonstrating military power, but also the vast mineral reserves and wealth that's there in Afghanistan to be exploited, the oil reserves that are there in Iraq to be exploited, and the oil reserves that are there in Libya to be exploited. We're in a global race for resources, and a global race means there's winners and losers. If you win, you control. But you have, there's a price at control, and that price is armed occupation. Surely, we need a much more rational approach to the world. We need to defend and protect our environment for all of us. We need to end the wars and start redistributing wealth rather than grabbing from each other.
Since the onset of the crisis in 2008, I think the cost of the war has become an additional issue, which angers people. I think they think, if you're going to reduce my wages and cut my welfare services, what the hell do you think you're doing, fighting wars which in any case I thought were wrong? And I think that's a very, very widely held view. The Trade Union Congress, representing 7 million workers, passed a resolution this year saying that the Afghan war should end, that the Iraq war was wrong, that the Libya intervention was wrong. And that, in addition to the opinion poll evidence, shows that many working people just don't accept the argument for the war and just don't accept the cost of it.
We're being told we're all in this together. Well, we're not all in this together. We're all being told to tighten our belts and be careful about our spending, and yet the government wants us to be supporting businesses. Well, we would support businesses if we didn't have to support the war. The government's always got money for war. It's always got money for warmongering. Why do we interfere in places like Libya? I think the money being spent on war should be put back into our economy. There's plenty of money. There's no need for any of these cuts. Believe you me, I am absolutely certain if the people who should be paying their taxes were paying their taxes, instead of, you know, big businesses, which is what I'm talking about, going off and putting their money in offshore accounts where they're not paying into the UK economy, if we weren't supporting the arms trade, and make no bones about it, I would imagine there's absolutely loads of ministers and people in the cabinet and the government who are paying, who are getting money back, rather, from profits from the arms trade and from war. Why do they give money for warmongering? Why do they support this? Well, they're also cutting the defence budget, I have to say, because they will profit from it, because it suits them. It suits Britain to be in a strategic military position around the world where there's oil, where there's mineral wealth. Where